You're listening to Keystone Cold Cases, a podcast where we reignite cold cases across Pennsylvania.
Hey, Murderitas, I'm Danica.
And I'm Shannon.
We are the mother-daughter hosts of Murder and Mimosas,
a true crime podcast that strives to focus on lesser-known cases.
We personally think these episodes go down a little bit better with a mimosa.
You sip, we share.
So grab yours and get ready, because every Saturday at brunch time is a new episode.
You can listen to us on any podcast platform.
Hi, it's Caitlin.
Hey, it's Janelle.
And hi, it's Shannon. Today we are taking a detour from our normal cases and covering a case of about an unsolvable string of murders that actually began over 100 years ago. So this case is just kind of like all over the place. So I'm going to ask forgiveness in the beginning here because I got a lot of information, but the information is so old, it's kind of all over the place. The most credible source I found was the Elwood City Ledger from Western Pennsylvania. And then there's another website, I forget the name of it right now, but it's more or less a website about the county, and some of the information was in there, and then like blog posts. So for our Western PA people, if you are familiar with the Murder Swamp and have anything to add or any questions, you know, please feel free to reach out through social media or on our email, keystonecoldcases@gmail.com, and give us your opinion or any facts that you may have heard, through, the passage of time from like family members or neighbors, things like that. So our story begins with an area ominously known by locals at the time as Hell's Half Acre. So this is like a swampy area between West Pittsburgh, and that's Pittsburgh without an H. West Pittsburgh and the rail yards at Newcastle Junction, bordered by the Pennsylvania and Lake Erie. I'll probably refer to that as P and L-E. Maybe not, because it doesn't sound like it's a lot easier to say. And the Baltimore and Ohio, or the B&O railroad tracks on the east, and then the Beaver River on the west. So it was a stagnant, like, inhabitable area and became known as the Murder Swamp because it was the perfect place for a murderer to leave his mutilated victims. So there's a lot of victims tied to this swamp. Everything started around, I'm going to say 1923, but in some of the sources, if you go look at them, you'll see 1925. Referenced first. So from 1923 to 1940, dismembered and decapitated bodies were found in the swamp and its surrounding area, most of them being male. But two of the earlier victims that may or may not be attributed to this murderer were children. So the first one was July of 1923. And a torso of a girl approximately 6 years old was found near Rock Point on the Beaver River. And I have a map that I'll put in with the blog post for the approximate location. So the torso, missing its head, arms, and legs, had been in the water for a long time, but no child had been reported missing and the body was never identified. And this was the first of these murders, and 11 of the victims were not identified.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's
to this day, they've never been identified?
Nope. Which,
oh wow.
Yeah, which the 6-year-old girl is strange, and like, honestly, I'm not sure that she could be, I mean, the the wounds, you know, the missing of the limbs, the missing of the head, is all consistent with the rest of the victims or majority of the victims. But being that she's a child and a female and not in the swampy area where most of the victims were found, you know, could just be coincidence.
Do you think a possibility was this was practice and maybe this was the murderer's children or someone close to the murderer?
It could be.
Or maybe he just happened upon a child. A lot of serial killers or murderers will start with the easier victim at first and then kind of work their way up. So that could definitely be a possibility.
Yeah. In October of 23, the decapitated body of 21-year-old Charles Chuck McGregor from Katanning was found in the women's dressing room at a municipal pool in Pittsburgh. This is Pittsburgh with an H, so, you know, Pittsburgh the city. And his head was later found. So he's kind of thought to be one of these victims as well.
How did he get somebody in the dressing room at a municipal pool without anybody seeing?
This case is just so crazy how nobody saw anything. Despite it happening pretty regularly for, you know, a long time. Over a decade. So the next case of these murders was another, like, a teenager. So on January 3rd, 1925, the charred remains of Luigi Noesi, I think that's how it's spelled. That's how I found it on another YouTube channel that somebody was covering his case. His charred remains were found in a boys' clubhouse, like, called the Timberwolves. There was apparently just this boys' club, and they had this rickety old clubhouse that they hung out at.
So it was like just a group of friends who made a clubhouse.
Yeah, that's how I understand it. Like, they refer to them, like, a lot as, you know, they're, you know, local Timberwolf, you know, club. And, you know, he was a Timberwolf. Like, so I don't know. I couldn't find anything that really indicated it was any type of organized club.
Yeah, because at first when I first read it, I thought maybe it was like a sports club or something. But then when I read it was like a shack that they had to climb in through the top. Right. I was like, okay, well, maybe not.
Yeah, it didn't sound like anything formal. Their clubhouse was along the Conaquinessing River. Forgive me if I butchered that. But Luigi left home on the morning of January 1st. And when he didn't return home by the next morning, his father reported him missing to police. So they did a search, didn't find him. So they just assumed he had ran away. That was up until another local teenager, L.M. Mason, approached the police with a chilling account relayed to him by Luigi's close friend and fellow Timberwolves club member, Joe Statty. So according to Joe, he and another friend and another Timberwolf, James Joseph, went to the clubhouse and found it on fire. And after the fire died down, they found what they thought were dog remains and then just buried those bones.
That's really strange.
Right?
I don't know.
I don't know either. I know that that's a little suspect to me because, you know, as I'm about to mention, the shack had no doors or windows and it was only accessible through a hole in the roof. And it was that corrugated metal. So it was just like, you know, probably something just thrown up for, you know, for the kids to hang out in. That's my guess anyway. So how did a dog get in?
So they just and they just sat there and watched it burn for until it went out. Right? Like, wouldn't that take a good like 2 hours?
And I'm wondering, did the metal burn? Did it melt? Like, or was it just that the inside was burning and, you know, maybe eventually it suffocated, it didn't get enough oxygen or something. And I don't know. It's
Do
very.
you know how far this shack was from like any other house or like road or anything?
It was along the river, so it was very like kind of isolated from what I could see. And this whole area was not really built up a lot, even though the railroad was there. I think this was a lot of, it's like land with a couple houses here there. I did see a picture. It wasn't a very good picture, but I did see a picture of where the approximate area the clubhouse was, and there was a railroad trestle nearby. But not really too much of anything else around it. And maybe that was the appeal, for the kids. For the teens, I guess they're not really kids. But there was a stove inside, and police, when they did search this shack, found two guns. So L.M. Mason had gone to the police because he knew Luigi was missing, and he thought the bones might be him, might be his. Police did find the bones, no arms, legs, or head, like no skull, no arm or leg bones, just, pretty much, I guess, probably pelvis and ribs and such. So.
That doesn't seem like something
Right.
teenagers would be able to
Right.
Well,
do,
my
though.
question is, you can only get it through this like hole on like the roof. So you're killing someone and then you're dragging a torso to throw it in the roof and then setting it on fire?
I don't like, I really,
That's a lot of work.
I know. And where my mind goes and pictures this clubhouse is just, it's so impractical.
Yeah.
So
That's a lot of work to like hide just part of a body because the other parts we don't know where they are, but wow, that's a lot of work.
Were the bones charred like when they found
It
them?
didn't say.
I'm curious if maybe the fire was separate from that or like they found it outside of the clubhouse somewhere and
Yeah, I'm not.
I don't know.
I'm just that this case, I found it fascinating, but it just stumped me as well. So Joe's daddy and James Joseph were taken into custody. Joe told police that he didn't report the events because he didn't want to be arrested. And James told the police that when he arrived at the clubhouse, Joe was already there watching it burn. So they did tell them that they were at the clubhouse New Year's Eve. They had roasted and eaten potatoes, and then they left around 9 a.m. New Year's Day, and there was no fire when they left, only a few hot ashes, according to them. So
So was the stove one of those ones where like you put make a
I'm
fire
thinking,
underneath, I
yeah,
guess?
maybe one of those little, like, kind of like a, I don't know, I'm thinking like a little cast
Like a
iron
wood
stove, yeah, that you,
burning stove.
yeah, something small like that is what I would be, was what I was picturing myself. So after the examination of the bones, it was determined that they were human bones of a male younger than 17 years old, but Luigi's family refused to accept the bones as belonging to him. So I did find another, like this one odd account that fits in but doesn't fit in cleanly. So there was an employee of the Pittsburgh and the Lake Erie Railroad who said he saw three boys running from the burning clubhouse, and thought, poor kids, their clubhouse is burning down. But I could only find one spot where that was accounted for. So I don't, I mean, it doesn't really
Well,
matter. It doesn't look like it went anywhere.
even if that were the case, all you said was poor kids, their clubhouse is burning down. Like, maybe I should call somebody
Right.
because this clubhouse is burning down and there's kids
Exactly.
on the property.
There's a fire. So
Like,
I don't know. I know. I was just like, I wonder, and I'm just kind of wondering if maybe somebody just tried to insert themselves in after the fact,
could be.
because
Yeah.
nothing came of that. I only saw it in one place, and it wasn't even, I don't think it was even in the actual newspaper article that I got majority of the information from. So, but then an inquest was held in Elwood City on the second floor of the firehouse. And so many people came to this that they had to like stand towards the walls to displace the stress from the weight of the people from the center of the floor. Like, could you imagine, like, so many people attend this that the floor collapses and now, you know, we have another thing to worry about. At the inquest, 15 witnesses testified, including Joe's daddy, James, Joseph, and some other Timberwolves. The coroner's jury decided that Luigi died in the shed between 8 a.m. and 2 p.m. on January 1st. The theory is Luigi was trapped in the building when it caught fire. However, that theory doesn't make sense because he didn't have arms, legs, or a head. So if he was caught in there, where's his skull? Where are his, you know, arms and legs? But, you know, 1923, it was probably just the best way to close the case, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
You know, and because Luigi's family, you know, did not believe that they were his remains, the Elwood City took charge of the remains and then buried them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So even after they were identified, his family still said they did not believe it was him?
Yep, because they could only say that they were the bones of a male younger than 17. So
they couldn't positively identify him. Like, he didn't have teeth or, you know, anything okay. they could yeah. use to identify him.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
That's sad to think if it was him, you know, they refused to believe it. And
yeah. And lived with that away. Question the rest of their lives, you know, like, yeah. you know, and that wondering of what happened to him. So I'm going to take kind of a step back to before 1923, because there is another odd case that kind of, you know, fits a little bit, same area. But it was a murder in 1921 of a 73-year-old woman named Emma Jackson. She lived near Rock Point, which is near where the 6-year-old girl's torso was found.
A 73-year-old, if they were early victims, that I feel like that may be like an older woman would probably be, if it was a male with early victims, maybe an easier person to control than.
Right. So, yeah, she lived along the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad tracks, and her son, W.C. Jackson, came home from work in Elwood City. He worked at a mill. So he arrived home around 4 p.m., and he was going to an outbuilding before going into the house, and he saw a man knocking on the front door of the house. No one answered, so the man left and started walking up the railroad tracks towards Elwood City. So W.C. then, you know, went into the house and found his mother's body laying crosswise across the bed with her throat cut, like, to the point of near decapitation. So this is why there, you know, it was kind of questioned, like, was this, you know, was this the first? Because we're, you know, almost, you know, the head's almost cut clean off. So W.C. thought maybe that the person that did that was still in the house. So he grabbed a shotgun and checked in all the rooms. And then he ran outside and yelled to the man who had been knocking on the front door. And the man, it turned out, was looking for another house. And then the two searched the house and the premises. And then W.C. called Constable W.C. Morrison, Coroner Dr. H.E. Helling, and Undertaker J.I. Porter from Elwood City. And they all began their investigation into Emma Jackson's death. Side note, apparently everybody goes by their first two initials in this area. At least right? In this story. Like everybody's like, you know, first and second initials L-M. And their last name. Yep.
In the last story, there's an L.M.
Yep. Oh, and there's more later, too. So. Unfortunately, the topography offered a lot of hiding places, and the train tracks a means of escape. So, you know, whoever, you know, did that was long gone. There was speculation that the killer was a transient, as many hobos, there's that word hobos, passed along the road, and many apparently stopped at the Jackson house asking for food, but they did rule out robbery. So it's just speculated that this is the first attempt at decapitation of this killer.
An amateur.
Yep.
That, you know, could have progressed into getting better at doing
right.
It.
With the exception of Emma and the 6-year-old, you know, if they, you know, were victims of the same, you know, the same suspect, all the other victims were male except for those two. So these murders continued for years, and a lot of them occurred in the month of October, as we'll see going forward. So, which, you know, led to all the residents in the area, like, just like dreading October.
Hey, KCC Pod listeners. Have you heard of FanList? Well, you should. FanList lets us at KCC Pod to create a podcast fan page to engage with all of you in a fun and interactive way. With FanList, we can receive audio messages from our fans, whether it be for listener questions, stories, feedback, or whatever you may like. FanList makes these audio messages public, social, and fun. They teach us at KCC Pod to reward our engaged superfans by incorporating your sound bites into our show. FanList's mission is to be the number one audience engagement platform for podcasters. Their goal is to help us engage with all of you, grow their referrals, and monetize our superfans. So go check us out on FanList. Our link is fanlist.com/KCCpod. We can't wait to interact with all of you. Again, that's fanlist.com/KCCpod. Go check us out.
So the next one occurred October 6, 1925, and steelworker Samuel J. Hares of Newcastle was out looking for wild ducks and other animals in the swamp, and he found the naked, decapitated body of a man under a log. He notified the Lawrence County Constable, Walter G. Bannon, and 2 days later, Detective C.W. Hicks was standing where the body was found and noticed a stronger odor than was present, you know, when the body was originally found. I'm assuming, you know, more decomposition. So he took a shovel and searched under the log and found the head. And it was right where the feet were the 2 days earlier when they found the body. So
that means he probably came back.
Unless they just didn't look deep enough. You know, maybe they they just found the body. And, you know, and one thing that is really prevalent in all these cases is there was like minimal attempts to hide these bodies. Like they were all pretty, you know, visible, you know, or just partially buried, like easy, you know, easy to stumble upon. So it wasn't like there was any type of, you know, concealment, you know, to.
But that also makes me wonder, if there was no type of concealment and it was pretty easy, then wouldn't it be pretty easy to have find a head right there too?
You would think.
Yeah. I don't know.
I would be curious to map all these areas on like Google Earth.
Yeah.
And see if there is like a, you know, like a highway or an area where they could travel that kind of goes in the direction of where everybody was.
Yeah. Like, I really wish there was like, you know, I mean, obviously at that time, not possible, but like some sort of like pin drops that where we could like, you know, show like, you know, body number one, body number four, you know, and the proximity. But mm-hmm. Other than the, you know, the first few that we've already talked about, all of these others are in that, you know, swampy area.
Yeah.
So in a separate location nearby where the body was, police found a hat, a length of rope, and a pile of burned clothing. So police displayed photographs of the head, hoping for identification, but did not find, or nobody came forward. And he has since been referred to as the Lawrence County John Doe.
I wonder if they use the river or the swamp to, like, bathe themselves. And maybe, like, him and another guy were, you know, out there. Because he was found naked. You know, what if they were there and he just took the opportunity and took him out?
Yeah. And because none of these victims are, you know, have been identified for the most part, you know, they may just all be transients. So there's, you know, nobody, there was maybe nobody actively looking for them at the time. So, you know, it was just really easy to kill them and, you know, get away with it. On October 17th, 1925, four teenage boys were duck hunting in the area near the site of that first, that body that had just been found. And then they found a partially hidden, partially clothed human skeleton, no head. Local authorities were contacted again and began searching for the skull to no avail. They did determine that the victim was male and that the death occurred at least 4 months prior.
Can you imagine what those four teenage boys, like what, like the trauma? Like you're just walking along and you find a body with no head?
Yeah. Oh. I know. It's just crazy. And it's just like, I mean, a lot of, you know, most people didn't venture in except for, you know, hunters and, you know, and maybe people just, you know, taking, you know, shortcuts, you know, to the river or what have you. But yeah.
So that happened in like July, I guess, or around July.
That was
the murder October. 4 months prior.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Okay.
October 19th, 1925, authorities were searching the area and found a human skull and another bundle of men's clothing. They assumed the head belonged to the skeleton that was found 2 days prior, but the coroner determined this to be another victim, possibly an elderly woman, with the death occurring at least a year before. So,
oh my.
So, you know, we have a head, we have a body, but they don't match.
And a year before.
That wasn't the woman we just talked about, right? Or we had her head?
Yeah, her head was still, you know, attached, but not by much.
Okay.
But yeah.
Okay.
The bundle of clothing was thought to be, to belong to the deceased found on 10/17. So the one that they had found 2 days before. So they thought those clothes belonged to that body. The clothes were cleaned and displayed in the window of the Cooper and Butler clothing store in Newcastle with the hope that someone would recognize the clothing, leading to the identification of one of the victims, and that did not pan out the way they'd hoped. On October 20th, a large search took place, assisted by the PA State Police. Volunteers met at noon and searched the swamp until dark. The Newcastle News reported on October 21st, some of the findings of the search included two sections of vertebrae, about 15 small bones, perhaps fingers or toes, a strip of dried human flesh, a blood-clotted mat of hair, and a dark blue cap. I'm not sure what a strip of dried human flesh looks like, but that sounds gnarly.
I think of, like, beef jerky.
Yeah, that's exactly, exactly what I was thinking of. Police believed that the person that was carrying out these murders to be, like, a strong, able-bodied man because the victims had to have been dragged a great distance into the swamp. And then due to the precision with which the heads were removed, it's likely that the suspect was skilled with a knife or saw, like indicating maybe someone in the medical profession or, you know, an experienced hunter. You know, and that area did have a lot of hunters, you know, especially, you know, in the swamp looking for animals and you know, and a lot of duck hunting went on in there.
That's why it gave me the railroad worker vibes, because yeah. a lot of the railroad workers had to be experienced probably with hand saws and
yep.
Cutting wood and
yeah.
So
the suspect knew the swamp, and due to the bodies being only partially concealed, was likely unconcerned about them being discovered. They believe he might have been a railroad employee who was familiar with Newcastle Junction. So investigators, they became bombarded with information about missing persons, leads, and theories, you know, about who was committing the murders, you know, the mob, a crazed nurse or doctor. But despite all of the information pouring in on that, you know, on that side, none of the victims were identified. And the case eventually went cold and quiet for the next 9 years. So again, this brings us to October the 16th, this time of 1934. So two men were running. I'm sorry?
I was going to say, that's like a whole decade later.
Yeah. Two young men were running dogs through the swamp, and they discovered the badly decomposed remains of a man naked and in a strange twist with his head intact. So this is a different, you know, different MO, I guess, you know, mm-hmm. although, you know, who knows if maybe somebody happened along and the, you know, this killer didn't get a chance to, you know, remove the head.
That's what I was just about to say. Maybe he got like interrupted and, yeah. you know, panicked. And
so the men contacted Constable Walter G. Bannon. It was getting dark, so the authorities, they secured the area, and then the next morning they went to the area to investigate, and with them was County Sheriff Edward P. Pritchard, the County Coroner Orville Potter. The Newcastle News reported that the body, quote, had been buried face downward and only partially covered with the sandy soil common to the surrounding area just at the lower edge of the swamp, end quote. The article went on to say that photographs were taken of the remains, quote, in the hope of developing some clue which might lead to unraveling the latest chapter in the gruesome mystery of this illicit burying ground, end quote. So it was determined that the body had been left there about 4 months prior, with a whiskey bottle, a large iron spike were found under the body also. So when I think of that large iron spike, I think of the ones that put, you know, that you use
the railroad.
To put the ties in the ground. So,
and you have to be really strong to do that, because mm-hmm. they would use sledgehammers and yep. bang them in. That definitely gives me railroad vibes.
Yeah. No clothes were found in the area, and they could not determine, the cause of death.
It's strange it was so many years later, but, I mean, that does happen where
yeah.
they go dormant for a little bit and
then, yeah.
you know, pop back up a few years later.
Yeah, maybe they get married and have a family and that falls apart or something, and, you know, we're relocated for the job, so it'd be interesting to know if there were, you know, around that, you know, during that dormant period here were some of these things happening somewhere else.
Yeah.
So this victim also was unidentified, but during this time, it's possible that the victim didn't get as much attention because this was about the time that Bruno Richard Hauptmann was arrested and about to go on trial for the kidnapping and murder of Charles Lindbergh's son. So everything was quiet again until July 1st of 1936, when two P and LE workers found an open box car with the decomposing body of a headless male. It was estimated.
So now we have inside a box car, like yep. a railroad box car. Oh, yep. Wow.
So it was estimated that the victim had been dead for several months. Investigators found a pouch of tobacco and remnants of three bloodstained newspapers from late July of 1933, two from the Pittsburgh Press and one from the Cleveland Plain Dealer, under the corpse. They wondered if, like, the location of the newspapers under the body was a coincidence or somehow related to the murder. But after a search of the area, no head, no clothing, and no additional clues were found.
Can I ask another question?
Of course.
When we first started doing this, the boys you mentioned, I think it was like Joe Staddy and someone else. Do we know
James Joseph
what his parents did for a living?
I did not find that information. There wasn't too much info on them other than, you know, being, you know, arrested and interrogated, you know, about Luigi's disappearance.
Okay. All right.
But maybe I can look into that and see if I can dig deeper and find, you know, find that information. Are you thinking they were tied to the railroad?
So my thought was, to watch a fire burn and not move, and someone has to come find you, watch a fire burn. Mm-hmm. You're either, you love arson and you love the thought, or you know what happened.
Yeah.
So that just makes me think either he was involved or he knows someone who was involved, and he was young at the time. So I was just wondering if he had family that may have worked the railroad.
Yeah, that's a good point. I'll look into that. See if I can provide an update. So the latest victim caught the attention and the interest of the Cleveland police. Torsos and skulls had also been found in Cleveland and were believed to be the work of an unidentified serial killer dubbed the Mad Butcher of Kingsbury Run. Famed law enforcement agent Elliot Ness even visited the area because he was investigating the Mad Butcher, and he confirmed with local officials about the case. The Cleveland victims were both male and female, and it's believed that those murders were sexually motivated, as most of the male victims were castrated. They didn't find any definitive evidence to link the Cleveland murders to the Swamp murders.
Yeah, that seems like the MO is pretty different with that, at least.
So again, the areas around the murder swamp went quiet until October 13th, 1939, when four boys looking for walnuts on the edge of the swamp discovered another decomposing headless body in the tall grass. The body had been piled with newspapers dated September 28th and burned. So this body was small in stature, and investigators initially believed it to be a female, but the coroner determined it was a young male, approximately 18 years of age. And then less than a week later, a P&LE employee found a dismembered head in an empty gondola car on the canal track, which the railroad track that's closest to the river. The head was covered in leaves and burrs, similar to those in the vicinity of the body. And it was determined that the head and the body were the same victim. As with the other victims, no one came forward to make an identification. So desperate for answers, police would go undercover in the transient population of Newcastle Junction, known at the time as Hobo Jungles.
Okay, did they do this in 1939, or did they do this prior?
No, in 1939. At least from...
So they waited this whole time to do that.
I wonder why he used newspapers. Because this is like the second or third one with the piled up newspapers, right? I think there was three where they mentioned. And then he said they were burned. So that goes hand in hand with the fire and possibly... You know,
and, you know, I'm wondering if, you know, finding the one body and now finding the head in the train cars is, you know, kind of what prompted them to go undercover in that transient community.
Yeah. I just wonder if it was too little too late at that point, just because it's been so long.
I agree. This was the last known incident in the Newcastle area, and police were never able to identify any prominent suspects. So now the area has been reclaimed by a power company, so there's not much of that swamp remains today. But, you know, I'm sure it's kind of very like haunting because of all the bodies that were found there, and it's like the most like unsolvable case, it seems, especially, we're 100 years past, the first one. So,
I mean, so anyone that would have done it is,
right.
I mean, obviously
Right.
not alive. And anyone that may have known anything is probably not alive either. So,
Yeah, it's almost,
I mean, it would be a reason to be able to
yeah, and
solve it.
it's almost like it's just going to pass into folklore now, there's probably very few, if any, people that were alive at the time to have, heard any type of firsthand accounts.
I wonder if the vibe I get from, all of the things put together is that it's this railroad worker who, camps out in the woods wherever they're working at the time, possibly, washing off of the water, using that as like a shower, building fires to keep warm. Maybe he found that clubhouse and camped out there for the night, and then the teenager showed up in the morning, climbed in there, and came face to face with him. And that's the only thing I can come up with, but now it kind of makes more sense as I'm reading along that
That's a good theory.
that's a possibility.
Squatters' rights, I guess, on the clubhouse.
If you got a stove, you got a wood-burning stove in there and a shelter you can use without having to do it yourself, it wouldn't shock me if someone climbed right in there,
Especially
started making
January
food,
in
whatever,
Pennsylvania,
and
when
then
we actually had winters, back then.
Yes, yep.
I do have a bunch of photos of articles from the time that will be out on the website on the blog post, along with all the links to the sources that I used for this case. So, feel free to go out and check. I did do some little maps of where, try to like show some of the locations where, or at least, a general area of where some of the bodies were found, where the clubhouse was. But definitely, if any listeners are familiar with this, from the Western PA area, I'd definitely be interested in hearing, some of the tales that have been passed down from that time. So definitely, please, if you have anything to add, please reach out, either through Facebook, or through the email, or through the
One of the
website.
actually the articles I was just looking at, like of the newspaper, it said the word, I don't know if I say this on a podcast if it would get us in trouble, so I'm gonna spell it, but it said NAZI. It was carved onto the torso, it says.
And
Like they
that's the
carved that
only place I
word.
saw that, like, it was in that. So I'm not, I don't know. Like, I did, that's, I didn't put that in my write-up, because like that was the only reference I found of that.
Case, like that was the only reference.
So,
Yeah,
but I mean,
makes
obviously it's
sense.
a newspaper of the time, but that would kind of take one in, into a whole other, direction, carving that into someone. Like,
Yeah.
why the one? What triggered that response?
Yeah, when I saw it, that's why I was like, oh wow, that changed, like that could change the whole MO of everything. So
So that's it.
interesting.
That's all we have for this episode of the Keystone Cold Cases podcast. Thank you so much for listening, and please consider leaving us a review wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to find out more information about the podcast, the hosts, and the cases we cover, or if you want to suggest a case, please visit us at kccpod.com or send us an email at keystonecoldcases@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Facebook at Keystone Cold Cases and on Instagram and TikTok at KCC Pod. Please remember never to reach out to family or friends of the victims, only to law enforcement if you have any tips. This episode was researched and hosted by me, Shannon. Find all of our sources, social info, and contact information at KCC Pod. Theme music by Darren Makins and production assistance from Shannon Bickle. Join us again next week for another case to sleuth out.